Okay, so we have our big hero series. And this morning we have Chris Wilkinson presenting. So big round of applause for Chris, please.
We're holding up the bypass. Oh, me and my dad having a top laugh. Oh, we're sitting on the toolbox. Oh, and I'm so glad I'm not in school, boss. So glad I'm not in school. And we're holding up the bypass. Oh, me and my dad having a top laugh. Oh, oh, I'm sitting on the toolbox. Oh, and I'm so glad I'm not in school, boss. So glad I'm not in school.
Hang on.
Said I'm Luke, I'm five, and my dad's Bruce Lee. Drives me round in his JCB. I'm Luke, I'm five, and my dad's Bruce Lee. Drives me round in his JCB. I'm Luke, I'm five, and my dad's Bruce Lee. Drives me round in his JCB. I'm Luke, I'm five, and my dad's Bruce Lee. Drives me round, and we're holding up the bypass. Whoa, and me and my dad having a top laugh. Oh, whoa. And I'm sitting on the toolbox. Oh,
okay.
And I'm so glad I'm not in school, boss. So
you get the picture. So I'm Luke, I'm five, and so if I just introduce myself quickly before I bring on my guests. So my name's Chris, Chris Wilkinson. I've been coming to the church for quite a long time, since we got married 13 years ago, 14 years ago. It's good job I brought my assistant with me. And I've got three children. I'm married to Claire. My three children are 2, 4, and 6 at the moment. I'm all about to clock on to a year older, all got winter birthdays. And I work at Noah's Ark Zoo. I am the curator there, so I work with the animals, although more and more less with the animals and more importantly the poo, but we with the animals in more of an organizational way, just doing the fun bits really, the hands-on. So this week we are going to be putting some contraceptive implants in lions, so that's something I'll definitely get involved in, but skipping out the poo every day we can get other people to do nowadays, which is lovely. So I have 25 keepers and about 400 animals that we are responsible for. So that keeps me plenty busy and at home. I live at the zoo, spend basically all the free time that isn't consumed with playing and enjoying with the children and doing family things, is building the house, building the other things, trying to not live in a building site. So that's me. So now I will invite my guest to fill the empty sofa. So this is my friend Richard. Everyone clap. Yeah, come and take a seat. I think the microphone's tucked around the corner. So
are we switched on? Oh, yeah.
We are switched on.
Thank you, so, Daniel.
So Richard and I are genuine friends, and we found that we both have a love for shooting. So a long time ago, we discovered that, and it led to many, many conversations. So I will allow him to introduce himself, but I wanted to get that in. I'm very glad that he said yes, he would come and sit next to me, and to be doing this with him. Richard, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chris. Well, as Chris said, I'm Richard. My name is Richard Newbold. I've known Chris's boss longer than Chris has been around on the planet. I used to go shooting a lot around what is now Noah's Ark Farm. Not sure how many elephants or tigers around there, but... I married to Jill, who's in the congregation. We got married 45 years ago. We've got three daughters and four grandsons. I'm now retired, but I don't really know how I found time to go to work, because it's the usual cliche that there's always, you know, more things to do than there are hours in the day. So that's me in a nutshell.
Lovely job. So we will begin with our Bible heroes. So I will allow you to go first.
Right. Well, thank you, Chris. I know this person's been chosen before, but I would put him as a Bible hero. I said to Chris it was pretty obvious who I was going to choose. It's Noah, based on the story from Genesis. Can you put the presentation up, please, Ben? Great. Now, this is what I... Rather than start with a quiz, I will start with something initially serious, but I'll try and whet your appetite, as it were, so that you can get immersed in the subject. And the puns are all intended. We all know the story, but this is just a sort of background. If you look at the genealogy of Noah from Genesis 5, and as we know, every name has a meaning. And if you look through, there's Adam, and his meaning is man. And Seth is appointed. Enosh, mortal, frail, miserable, is from the root word meaning incurable. Kenan, sorrow, dirge, or algae. I'm not quite sure what I put up there. Anyway, then obviously they decided that we got a bit fed up with naming kids fairly despondent names. So the next one is a bit of a mouthful, Mahalalel, which is blessed or praise, and the El at the end is, as we know, a name for God. Jared means shall come down. Enoch, commencement or teaching. Methuselah, his death shall bring. This is an interesting one because I've probably known for years that was the meaning for Methuselah. And as we know, he was the longest living person in the world. And when he says his death shall bring, the flood started when Methuselah died. And it was a case that God waited and waited and waited until the last minute, as it were, before bringing the flood. And Methuselah just kept hanging on and on to life.
And waited and waited and waited and waited.
And waited and waited and waited, yes. So it's just a little bit of, you know, showing God's care and love for his world. Lamech, lament or lamentation, from the root word meaning despairing. And then Noah means comfort or rest. So you think, well, what does all that mean? And if you can put it to the next one, please, Ben. If you put it all together, you've got the gospel message in Noah's genealogy. Man is appointed mortal and sorrowful, but the blessed God shall come down, teaching that his death shall bring to the despairing comfort and rest. And that is something which I can't claim credit for, but if you delve into the meaning of and the rest of what's behind a familiar story, there's an awful lot more which God can teach you. So going on to Noah, we all know, as I said, the story, but if you think of it, there was no rain. All the up until then, the only water had come from like a heavy dew. There'd been no rain through the clouds as we even know it. And then God told Noah to build an ark, or a barge is probably more appropriate. And it's not just a little, you know, one which you can sail on a lake somewhere. I was trying to work out how big it was, and if you take the aircraft carriers if you take the aircraft carriers we used to have, Invincible, etc., that, and if you sailed out from Portsmouth any time, yeah, in the 80s and 90s, you would have probably seen at least one of them docked in the harbour there. The Ark wasn't that big, but it was about two-thirds the length and about two-thirds the width, something like that. It was a pretty big undertaking which Noah had to make an ark. And it took him 100 years, and it wasn't something which you would do on your own. He must have been a very wealthy person because you had to go around. You can't just phone up Staddon's and say, I want a big delivery of timber, please. He's got to go somewhere, cut it down, get people to bring all the timber to put it together to make the ark. And all these other people who were making it, obviously must have thought him mad, but if he was paying them to do a job, so he would carry on and, they would carry on and work for him. To be a boss and everyone thinks you're mad can't be exactly the best situation. Plus, it just went on and on for 100 years. You know, it's not a five-minute wonder. God gave specific dimensions to the ark. And if you go into the theory of ships or floating objects, it is an incredibly stable shape. It's virtually impossible to capsize. So God knew that, but nobody on the earth had been floating anything around because there wasn't water to float on like that. The other thing which God told Noah to do was to seal it with pitch inside and outside, again, to preserve it. And the other interesting thing, the word which is translated pitch, every other time in the Old Testament is translated as atonement, which, again, the ark was there for protection and God's atonement was there to protect the ark. So there's a whole heap of things which I think is not written in the text, but if you delve into it and think about it, Noah was quite a special character. And if we can go probably to... this was the best picture I could have of Noah. It's an old geezer. being semi-serious, this is Old Faithful in Yellowstone Park. Now, this geezer erupts at a known time. It's very dependable, when it's going to erupt, and we know exactly where it's going to be. This sort of thing was happening all over the world. Nobody knew where it was coming from. It hadn't happened before. Yeah, it must have been pretty frightening for those left behind. But God had left it as long as he could, as I said, with Methuselah living as long as he did. Then people would have seen all the animals going onto the ark. And then God would have shut the door. And then that was it. Yeah, the time for joining Noah was finished. Yeah, they'd had 100 years of Noah preaching to them and knowing what was coming. So, as well as the rain, which we know about, it says the waters of the deep came up. And this is just a small example of the waters of the deep. And then it was, the ark was floating around for... they were in the ark over a year, initially floating around, and then it was, as we know, on Mount Ararat, and then it finally the waters subsided enough for them to come out. And up until then, there'd been no rain, so there'd been no rainbow. But if we can go on to the next one, Ben... The rainbow, as we probably all know, is God's promise he will not flood the earth again. And so often, we can look at that and say, God won't flood the earth again. And some people try and make out the flood was just a local event. Well, there's been some pretty major flooding areas. And so if the flood of Noah was just a local event, then God's a liar because there have been so many... big floods since Noah's time. So the rainbow is a sign that God will not flood the earth fully again. And again, it's part of showing how true the Bible is. Now, I've picked Noah because if Noah had not done as he'd been asked to do, we wouldn't be here now. It was not Well, Noah was plan A, and then I got plan B and plan C. It was Noah or nothing. And so we have a great deal to thank God and thank Noah for his obedience to God.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, yeah, yeah. I think I obviously working at Noah's Ark have spent a while over time thinking about the story of Noah, and there's a few things that stick out to me. And first of all, you don't start a breeding program with two animals. So if you've got animals that are going from the ark to repopulate the earth, I mean, you don't want a human race based on six families or four families. But anyway, that the genetics shows me that God must have been there doing something if this is as it was. And the idea of dealing with that many animals in that confined space doesn't sound exciting, but it does say the animals will come to you, and so you don't have to. He didn't have to go out and catch all the animals, which was a massive help, because even a pair of sheep can waste all day. So I think there are lots of things in there that you think this cannot be just a circumstance story, but there's a story of a flood and a worldwide flood in every civilization around the world. So there's a common theme that everybody. Ancestors remembers, but yeah, and the rainbow, it says, was a promise not only to us as people but also to the animals, and I always think that speaks of how highly God thinks about creation, not just us. And sometimes I think we forget that a little bit, that we are stewards of something that God cares about a lot. Yeah, good, thank you.
Yeah,
so mine is in the Old Testament too, and it's a bit of a strange one in some ways, but mine is Samson. And he was a character, wasn't he? I think, so I was just doing a bit of homework because I thought, okay, I've got to set the scene for this, and actually came across possibly the same people that Verna used, the Bible Project, on YouTube, and I thought, you know what, why try and re-say it when it's said so well? So there's a video that explains the book of Judges in about 3 minutes, and I thought, yeah, that lays a great foundation. So we're gonna play that now, I hope, and then I will tell you why specifically.
So remember, after Joshua led the tribes of Israel into the Promised Land, he called them to be faithful to their covenant with God by obeying the commands of the Torah. And if they do this, they will show all the other nations what God is like. So Judges begins with the death of Joshua and basically tells the story of Israel's total failure. The book's name comes from the type of leaders Israel had in this period. Before they had any kings, the tribes were all governed by these judges. Now, don't think of a courtroom. These were regional political military leaders, more like a tribal chieftain. And you need to be warned, the book of Judges is very disturbing and violent. It tells the tragic tale of Israel's moral corruption, of its bad leadership, and basically how they become no different than the Canaanites. But this sad story is also meant to generate hope for the future, and you can see this in how the book's designed. There's a large introduction that sets the stage for Israel's failure as they don't drive out the remaining Canaanites. Then the large main section of the book has stories about the growing corruption of Israel's judges, and the progression here shows how Israel's leaders go from pretty good to okay to bad to worse. The concluding section is really disturbing and shows the corruption of the people of Israel as a whole. So let's dive in, and we can explore each part a bit more. The opening section begins with the tribes of Israel in their territories in the Promised Land. And while Joshua defeated some key Canaanite towns, there was still a lot of land to be taken and lots of Canaanites living in those areas. And so chapter 1 gives a long list of Canaanite groups and towns that Israel just failed to drive out from the land. Now, remember, the whole point of driving out the Canaanites was to avoid their moral corruption and their way of worshiping the gods through child sacrifice. God had called Israel to be a holy people, and that does not happen. Chapter 2 describes how Israel just moved in alongside the Canaanites and adopted all their cultural and religious practices. And it's right here that the story stops. For nearly a whole chapter, the narrator gives us an overview of everything that's about to happen in the body of the book. This part of Israel's history, the narrator says, was a series of cycles moving in a downward spiral. So Israel became like the Canaanites, and so they would sin against God. So God would allow them to be conquered and oppressed by the Canaanites, and eventually the Israelites would see the error of their ways and repent. So God would raise up a deliverer, a judge, from among Israel who would defeat the enemy and bring about an era of peace. But eventually Israel would sin again, and it would all start over. This cycle provides the literary design and flow for the next main section of the book. It gets repeated for each of the six main judges whose stories are told here. Now, the stories of the first three judges, Othniel, Ehud, and Deborah, they are epic adventures. They're also extremely bloody stories. Either the judge themselves or people who help the judge, they defeat their enemies and deliver the people of Israel. The stories about the next three judges are longer, and they focus in on the character flaws of the judges, which get increasingly worse. So Gideon, he begins pretty well. He's a coward of a man, but he eventually comes to trust that God can save Israel through him. And so he defeats a huge army of Midianites with only 300 men carrying torches and clay pots. But Gideon has a nasty temper, and he murders a bunch of fellow Israelites for not helping him in his battle. And then it all goes downhill from there. He makes an idol from the gold that he won in his battles. And then after he dies, all Israel worships the idol as a god, and the cycle begins again. The next main judge is Jephthah, who's something of a mafia thug living up in the hills. And when things get really bad for Israel, the elders come to him begging for his help. And Jephthah was a very effective leader. He won lots of battles against the Ammonites, but he was so unfamiliar with the God of Israel, he treats him like a Canaanite god. He vows to sacrifice his daughter if he wins the battle. This tragic story, it shows just how far Israel has fallen. They no longer know the character of their own God, which leads to murder and to false worship. The last judge, Samson, is by far the worst. His life began full of promise, but he has no regard for the God of Israel. He was promiscuous, violent, and arrogant. He did win brutally strategic victories over the Philistines, but only at the expense of his own integrity, and his life ends in a violent rush of mass murder. Now, a quick note here. You'll notice a repeated theme in the main section of the book, that at key moments, God's Spirit will empower each of these judges to accomplish these great acts of deliverance. Now, the fact that God uses these really screwed up people doesn't mean he endorses all or even any of their decisions. God is committed first and foremost to saving his people, but all he has to work with is these corrupt leaders. And so work with them he does. This whole section is designed to show just how bad things have gotten. You can't even tell the Israelites and the Canaanites apart anymore, and that's just the leaders. The final section shows Israel as a whole hitting bottom. There are two tragic stories here, and they are not for the faint of heart. They're structured by this key line that gets repeated four times at the close of the book. In those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. The first story is about an Israelite named Micah who builds a private temple to an idol, and that gets plundered by a private army sent from the tribe of Dan. So they come and they steal everything, and then they go and burn down the peaceful city of Laish and murder all of its inhabitants. It's a horrifying story. When Israel forgets its God, might makes right. The final story of the book is even worse. It's a shocking tale of sexual abuse and violence, which all leads to Israel's first civil war. It's very disturbing. And that's the point. These stories are meant to serve as a warning. Israel's descent into self-destruction is the result of turning away from the God who loves them and saved them out of slavery in Egypt. And now Israel needs to be delivered again from themselves. The only glimmer of hope in this story is found in this repeated line in the last part of the book. It actually forms the last sentence of the story. Israel has no king. And so the stage is set for the following books to tell the origins of King David's family, the book of Ruth, and also the origins of kingship itself in Israel, the book of 1 Samuel. But the story of Judges has value as a tragedy. It's a sobering explanation of the human condition, and ultimately it points out the need for God's grace to send a king who will rescue his people. And that's the book of Judges.
Yeah, I thought that was quite good, so I didn't want to try and mess it up. Thank you. So, why choose the worst of the worst as a hero? Well, I guess I'm not really choosing Samson, but I'm choosing the story of Samson. There's nothing specific about him or his things that he's done or anything that I would say I necessarily am looking to emulate in myself. However, the story of Samson, and particularly the story of Samson as written and more importantly drawn in this old Bible, this children's Bible that I've seen on lots of other people's shelves that's usually covered in dust, the drawings in it are like old-fashioned paintings. But that is the story that engaged me the most as a young person, that as a small child, when I wasn't interested in reading, I have dyslexia and a horrible relationship with reading. To now, I will avoid it like the plague. If you want information to get to me, don't write it down, tell me. Show me in a video is even better. And so being coming through as a young'un, through Sunday school, and my parents did a great job at you know, helping me to know the Bible stories, but they were all a bit weak as through my young person's eyes. They were not exciting. There was nothing in there that was like, oh, I'd love to hear that again. And then you get to the story of Samson, and he smashes 1,000 people with the ox of the jawbone of a donkey, and you think, cool. This is a story I want to hear again. So I think that, and to be honest, when I was getting a fondness for that story, most of the moral stuff, you know, just went straight over my head. But it remains a story that I read with the children now, but that really held my attention with this book, which now I love. I don't read enough of, but I love the complexity and the detail and the way that we can really know the Father's heart and see how the massive, great story ties in with untold numbers of rhythms of themes, and like Richard showed us with the genealogies, and it's an incredible book and an incredible tool. But I would have probably lost my interest in it possibly forever as a young'un, as I have seemed to have formed my relationship with reading as a young'un forever, had it not been for that story, which was like the things that you see on the telly. It was superhero-ish, and I didn't understand what was going on, but you know, God was there, and so was this incredibly violent man telling stories that you could sort of relate to what you were seeing on in fiction. So I think that the story of Samson is something that has had a big effect on me, for maybe in slightly more superficial reasons than the story of Israel, but nonetheless, 'tis real for me, and has and will remain a solid part of the history of why I've, or through my young years particularly, but that is the foundation that we now build on for not giving up with this book of sissies or whatever, you know. I think that there are loads of stories that inspire me now, but I think that was definitely one that kept me engaged. So that's why Samson is a bit of a hero, not because he was morally corrupt. Right, so we reach the midpoint of our thing. So we're going to do a quick quiz, and we'll keep it quick because time is tracking on and we don't want to run out of time. So I put together I mentioned TV people, so there's a few slides that are going to come up, and I want you to try and guess who they are. Now, if you're my generation, or you had kids that were young when I was, you will probably be an advantage to everybody else. My intention was to make TV cartoon heroes through, but then it was so, I found it so interesting doing just my era that we abandoned everything else. I also found that there's only two eras I know, like very immediate, now my kids are watching cartoons, and when I was, and I know nothing about in between that little thing. I didn't even know what that was. I thought it was some sort of pig, but no, it's some sort of hero. Does anyone know who this is? Not Action Man? G.I. Joe. Well done, Daniel. Yeah, you can be chocolate mice too while I throw things at you. Okay, G.I. Joe? Who's that? He-Man. Oh, a few people got that over this direction. Yeah. By the power of Greystone, indeed. Next one. Who are they? Ghostbusters. God, you need to shower it out. I think someone over there was pretty quick. Very good. Next one. Easy. Teenage Ninja Turtles. I don't know, someone over the back there. Ruth, maybe Tom was quite quick. Yeah, Andy. I don't know if I've got any more. Yeah, there's some more. Who's that?
Banana Man.
Banana Man. Over there somewhere. Kate, was it you? When Eric eats a banana. Power Rangers. I didn't even... Who said that first? Honesty time, I have no idea. Someone back there, well done, Ruth. Okay. Inspector Gadget, yeah. Tanya was pretty quick then. Slightly trickier, but one of my personal favourites. Not Thundercats. Biker Mice from Mars. Yes, Ben at the back. That was a big favourite of mine. Also love motorbikes. Well done. Next one. Captain Planet. Yeah, there's two there. One over here again. Someone over there. Was that you, Amy? Yeah, well done. I'm not sure how many more there are. Oh, who's that? There was toys, little toys. It's like the boy Polly Pocket. Yeah? Not Peter Pocket. Anyone? Ben? Max something? Mighty Max, that one. Mighty Max. I think it was, I had my childhood crushed by watching a documentary where they said most of the things that you watched were just, they invented the toy, then made the program so that you'd want to buy the toy. So it's like, oh, and I think this is one of those. But anyway, that's Mighty Max.
Did you ever leave the house?
Saturday morning telly was at its best. In the 90s. Okay, I think this is the last one. Anyone know who that is?
Captain Bucky O'Hare.
Bucky O'Hare. Well done. I knew Ben would be good at this. Very good. Is that the last one? No, he hasn't got the answers. I didn't even write them down. Are you done? Is that the last one? Yeah, magic. Okay. So we're doing real life heroes now. So I'm going to ask Richard if he wants to go first again and just introduce who and why you've got for your hero.
Right, this is quite difficult because there are an awful lot of people who I would say I would admire, yeah, but a lot of them are doing, they're good sportsmen because, yeah, they are achieving what they want to do. They're doing it for their own personal gains. And trying to think through somebody or... somebody who gives of the little they've got. And we've had, over the years, two kids we sponsored with Compassion. If we can put the first one up, Ben. This is our current one, Jack. He lives in Mexico. And last Christmas, we had a letter back from him to say, or after Christmas, to say, thank you so much for the money you gave us. I bought a mattress and I share it with my brother. And you think that he's giving, yeah, what little he's got and he's sharing with his brother. Now, normally, kids that age will be fighting like mad and, you know, certainly not sharing stuff. And so Jack is a great example of a hero, And if we go on to, this is Jay. Now, he graduated from the program a few years back. And that was the first picture we had of him and the last picture we had. And he progressed during the 15 years or so, we were sponsoring him. And he had a lot of hardship in his life. The house got damaged in the typhoon, and we were, at the time I was working, we were able to help send some money to put the house, repair the house. His dad was very ill, and a lot of their household money was spent on medication. Then his dad died, and so Jay became the breadwinner for the family. He was just a sacrificial, he gave sacrificially to the benefit of the rest of his family. And he didn't have much. He was pretty malnourished when we first had the picture, and he's not exactly fat on the last picture we had. So, our two compassion kids, and I think people like that in general, are heroes, because they are the unsung heroes. They give of the little they've got to the benefit of others. So that's it in a nutshell.
Lovely. Thank you. So for my real-time hero, I'm going to stick with the theme that we've had through a number of these, which is family. And I'm going to choose my grandfather. A few smiles. And I was wondering, why does our family end up being so... Why has that come up so much in this, with all the great things? And I think that it's those that invest in us, that journey with us, that love us the most, that we are the most affected by. So in some ways, I'm maybe not surprised that that's happened. Do you want to just run through the pictures? Leave the video and we'll see if we've got time for that, but we are chasing the clock down. So in doing this, it was interesting to gather some things that I didn't know about my grandfather. So that's obviously him. His name is Howard, Howard Wilkinson. And so these are just some of the... a little bit about him. So he was born in 1925 in Sutton Coalfield, where he lived with his father, he must have had a fairly, although his father seemed to be quite frugal, quite an affluent upbringing. His father was co-founder of Halford Cycles, so there was family money around. And so he was brought up in a house of giving. His father gave, I'll pause it on that one in a minute. His father gave a lot of money to charity, built church buildings with the money he had. He then went to Birmingham University to do mechanical engineering. He was enlisted in the army just at the end of World War II, so we don't think that he saw any fighting, but there are pictures of him in uniform. He worked in Birmingham for Dunlop Tyres, developing new composites and designs of tyres, and then got married in 1950 to my granny, who was in the picture. In 1962, moved to Tickenham and started working in Rolls-Royce, was building Concorde engine, specifically working on the fuel lines and the reliability of the fuel. And the things that stick out about my grandfather is, so he died in 2003, and I was 17, and I feel like I was only just starting to get to know what we had in Grandpa before he passed. I'm not going to look at the picture too much, or I'll definitely cry, and we haven't got time for that. So hopefully I did all of that while we were preparing. He was... there we go, he's retiring. He was somebody that... He was so much fun, and... It was always great to be around him. He always had time for people. He was such a faithful man in his Christian faith. He would regularly be known, and you could see it happening in front of you, getting alongside people that were having a hard time, people, to use an old-fashioned term, down and outs. And my dad was telling me stories of regularly having homeless people living in their house with them. They had a very big house at the time. It's still in Tickenham, Middleton House. It's got ivy growing down the side of it. I think there are four houses in their garden now, and the house has been divided in two. So they had lots of space, and they were bringing in people, but not all. But that did have a cost to them. They were burgled by people that were staying with them. The car was tried to be robbed because they knew where the hider key was. But I didn't stop him continuing to pursue that sort of discipleship life. I remember at his funeral, my dad said he never heard him preach a sermon. Yet he was incredibly effective for the kingdom. He walked with a lot of people in a really strong and meaningful way. And I could see that, although I didn't know what I was looking at the time. And I really am sad that I didn't get to know him as an adult before it was just grandpa and you could start to be a bit more aware of the gem that you had. He had an amazing way to... I love building things, particularly out of old stuff. And he was an absolute master at that. There are some pictures, maybe if there might be some, yeah, run some more. The picture of the, this is one of his creations that took him 2 years in his shed. He didn't weld, but he made a four-seater bike with nuts and bolts and bits of old bikes. Apparently the most challenging thing was making the back wheel, which is a motorbike wheel, freewheel, because they had fixed sprockets, but anyway. But I think I'm not surprised that Grandad liked making tandems because that was something that you did with other people. You do that, you ride those bikes. They had a two-seater, a three-seater, and a four-seater, that being the biggest, and all other manner of rusty contraptions that he made that we all used to cycle around on. The car in the picture was a car at the scrapyard that he used to own. I don't think it was even his most recent car, but he'd tracked it down and gone back to the scrapyard to get bits off it a couple of cars later, and he was apparently over the moon when he found that car in the scrapyard. And when I saw that picture as I was flicking through, I was like, oh, guarantee Grandpa's not dropping something off there. He's going to get something. And that's exactly what was happening. I'm one of 10 of my generation, so 10 grandchildren, 4 children. And we have a phrase in our family where it's Esther coined and we've adopted, which is crazy like felt pens. It doesn't really mean much, but it means crazy in a fun way. Oh, this is Pete's family, because that's Pete's hero on the left. So Pete's family journeyed with my family for quite a long time, and they were intertwined. In fact, in some of the old videos, they say that when the Wilkinsons met the Judsons, that was both of their families changed forever. So Worthington's, Judsons are the same family. So, and that's Kate to be embarrassed by her wedding picture. honoured, not embarrassed. A lot of hair, yeah. So I think that, I don't know if there's any more pictures, but, oh yeah, there we are. One quick last story instead of the video. So this is the train track that went round the loft of my grandfather's house. Now this is the way that he and I spent a lot of time together. I didn't really care about trains that much. I wasn't massively into Thomas as I remember, but it was something fun to do with Grandpa and he'd take me along. So he, in his genius, so take that engine there. So maybe it was one like that that started, but I remember one specific train where he decided that he could put a bigger motor in that train and it'd go faster, but then it needed more power, so he put a carriage on the back which just had batteries in it, and then it would wheel spin too much, so he would strap a load of lead over the top to weigh it down. And I remember going to, so it looked hideous, didn't look like a train at all, but mechanically it was outperforming the others, and it would tow more carriages around than everything else and all of that. And we went to this train track. Now most model railways are like Thomas Tank Engine sets. They're very precise. Everyone's made every tiny little fat controller and all the little bushes, and it's lovely. And we went to this train show, and everyone's laid their stuff out, and like, if you've brought your train, you can put it on the track and take it round. And Grandpa's like, oh, and he's like, yeah, have a go. So we get, the guy doesn't know what he's said yes to, so we bring out this thing out of the shopping bag, donk on the thing, flick it on, the thing's wheel spinning and sparking as it goes, tries to take off around this track, and the guy's like, take it off, is he in my track? So but it's gone, so we can't catch it. I will always remember that. So that is the kind of crazy like felt pens that my grandpa was. Totally good. Mechanically a genius, an absolute soldier for God, and will always be a hero. I wish I could, and Claire didn't even meet him, I wish my children could meet him. But gone but not forgotten, till we meet again. There's me. You want to play the video?
Yeah.
Okay, play the video. It's hard to get a picture of Grandpa because that is how he always was. So there he is filming. And there are three clips clipped together, I think. Okay, so this is my youngest sister's dedication. My grandfather, this is filmed off the telly with my phone, unfortunately, but that's him on his back there. Doing Ring a Ring of Roses. I'm a bit on the left and it's a bit dark, you can't see, but so note my grandfather rolls onto his back with his legs in the air. And a whole load of chit chat. I think he's saying, "Did you see? I nearly kicked you in the head, Uncle Mike." 18 buttercups. So here we come round for the next go. Down goes Grandpa. And there's me on the right with my legs in the air, doing exactly as my grandfather just did. A little bit hairier in those days.
And I have never seen Christopher ride a push bike like he is today. You're going to show us how he crashes into the wall? There he goes. Now that's good, isn't it? Yeah, he's managed to avoid coming up. Oh, I see, okay.
So there must have been, in my memory, about 20 of those little bikes hanging up in his garage. So we put this clip in because it sums up Grandpa very well. Can you see anything missing from that tricycle? A back wheel. We got two other wheels, right? And that was just typical grandfather. He probably put that together out of about two other bikes. So this is a family legend video where the tripod gave up and the thing tipped back. But that sort of hoot was normal when we were at Grandpa's house. So I'm on the floor there on the left, and that's my mum and my dad and a few other people that aren't here anymore. So there we go, a little bit of family archive for you. So yeah, a lot of fun, and yeah, until we meet again. But my grandfather is my hero. Good.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.